Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. For those of you I might not have met, I'm Ian Lesser from GMF here in Brussels, and a very warm welcome to all of you, and also all of you who are joining us via the live streaming of this event this morning. At the outset, let me just express our thanks to the NATO Public Diplomacy Division and to our friends at NATO as a whole. It's always a pleasure to work with them, and we're really grateful for the opportunity to be able to have this event today. We're especially honored to have NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg with us, to have the opportunity to hear his thoughts on European defense and transatlantic security. We've had the pleasure of having you with us at Brussels Forum and in other settings, and I remember one instance in particular. We were just talking about this actually coming in. I think just after you had arrived, it was in October 2014, you were kind enough to come and do a policy address and a conversation with GMF's president, Karen Donfried, and it was quite remarkable as a conversation on many levels. Your candor and talking about the challenges at that time and the opportunities and so forth. More than 2 years on, I think you'll agree, I think you'll all agree, that the situation in the world has not gotten simpler. And that those challenges have not gotten easier, and that in some ways across the Atlantic they've become even more interesting, but also presenting some new opportunities. I know we're going to hear a bit about these things, but much has also happened in the meantime. There's been a very successful summit in Warsaw. There's new energy in NATO-EU relations, and I know you're going to speak a bit about that today. So much has happened, and we're happy to have you with us again. Finally, let me just say how much GMF values having conversations like this. Our mission, for those of you who know us, is very simple, actually. It's to strengthen transatlantic cooperation, and we very much have a feeling, for many reasons, that this is our moment. Secretary General, as you've rightly said, going it alone is not an option. Not an option for Europe, not an option for the United States. We very much share that view. Before giving the Secretary General the floor, let me just say a very brief word about a roadmap of how this will work today. We will have thoughts from the Secretary General. Then we're going to have an armchair conversation here for a few minutes to elaborate on some of these points. And then we'll open it up to all of you for your questions and your comments. And finally, if you would like to tweet about today's event, you can do that at GMFUS with hashtag GMFNATO. So once again, welcome to you all. Secretary General, welcome, and the floor is yours.
So, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, thank you for this very warm welcome, and thanks to the German Marshall Fund and to Ian for hosting me and all of us today. And the German Marshall Fund is a truly transatlantic organization. And the German Marshall Fund is important for many, many reasons, but especially because the German Marshall Fund is really contributing to strengthen the transatlantic bond and to build bridges across the Atlantic. And the GMF has been doing that for decades, and this is as important as ever in the uncertain times we are living in today. I will give you a speech, and then afterwards I'm happy to answer your questions and to take part in a dialogue with all of you. But let me start by just stating the following, and that is that Europe needs America, and America needs Europe. So this morning I want to talk about what binds us together, to explore the fundamental connection between the transatlantic bond and European security, and to outline what I believe we need to do to sustain that bond and maintain that security. Today marks exactly 100 years since the final day of the Battle of the Somme, one of the bloodiest campaigns in the First World War, a battle in which over 1 million men were killed or wounded. On the eve of the First World War, British Foreign Secretary Sir Edward Grey had been sure that peace would prevail, that if war threatened, European nations would, in his words, call a halt and recoil from the abyss. He was wrong, like so many others. The European powers could not call a halt, and the result was utter destruction. Two decades later, Europe was once again engulfed by war, and the sons of those Americans and Canadians who had fought in Flanders fields were asked to fight their way across the beaches of Normandy. But soon after the liberation of Europe, an iron curtain fell and divided the continent. So two world wars and the Cold War have taught us that the security of Europe relies on the United States, and that the United States has a profound strategic interest in a stable and secure Europe. Today, the United States continues to demonstrate its commitment to Europe's security. It will deploy a new armored brigade to Europe and deliver equipment and supplies to support future reinforcements if needed. And at the same time, Europeans have always been there for America too. Since NATO was founded in 1949, America has had no more steadfast and reliable partner than Europe. Europe is America's best friend. NATO has been a unique force multiplier, a platform from which to project strategic interests and for working seamlessly with allies and partners around the globe. We have to remember that the only time when NATO has invoked our collective defense clause, Article 5, was in solidarity with the United States as a direct response to the attacks 9/11-2001. Since then, hundreds of thousands of European troops have served in Afghanistan. Over 1,000 have paid the ultimate price. And NATO continues to play a crucial role in the fight against international terrorism. Every NATO ally is part of the US-led coalition to counter ISIL, drawing on decades of experience working together in NATO exercises and operations. Our AWACS surveillance aircraft support coalition air operations. NATO is training Iraqi officers to better fight ISIL. And we work with others throughout North Africa and the Middle East to help them improve their security. Europe and the United States are also close economic and trade partners. Together they account for 1/3 of world trade and 1/2 of global economic output. A stronger, safer and more prosperous Europe means a stronger, safer and more prosperous United States. This is an essential lesson of 20th century history. And we should not forget it, especially in uncertain times such as these. Russia breaking international law, turmoil in North Africa and the Middle East, the refugee and migration crisis, international terrorism, hybrid warfare, and cyber attacks. These are pressing challenges requiring unity and resolve and a strong transatlantic bond. To do that, we Europeans recognize that we have work to do. Crucially, Europe must do more on defense and security. And an important part of that is closer cooperation between NATO and the European Union. I welcome ongoing efforts to strengthen European defense. But we need to ensure it is done in a way which strengthens, not weakens, the transatlantic relationship. For me, as Secretary General of NATO, there are three key points. More money for better capabilities, complementarity, not competition, and involvement of non-EU allies. First, some words about more money for better capabilities. It is no secret that the United States has called for European allies to spend more on defense. We have heard that call many times from many American leaders, from President Obama and from President-elect Trump. From every senator and congressman I have met since becoming Secretary General. And delivering on defense spending has been my top priority since the day I took office. I raise this in every NATO capital I visit. And I welcome the fact that Europeans are now stepping up. At our summit in Wales in 2014, all allies made a pledge to stop cuts in defense spending and to gradually increase spending towards the goal of 2% of GDP within a decade. Last year, for the first time in many years, we stopped the cuts across Europe and Canada. This year, we expect a 3% real increase in defense spending in Europe and Canada. But other than the US, only four NATO allies spend 2% of GDP on defense. If all allies did, that would mean an extra $100 billion, a $100 billion boost to our capabilities. That is roughly equivalent to the combined budgets of the largest defense spenders in Europe, the UK and France, every year. So we still have a long way to go, but we are heading in the right direction. This week, the EU also took steps in the right direction, agreeing on measures to implement the global strategy in the area of security and defense. They should lead to more efficient spending and better defense capabilities. One issue we need to address better is the fragmentation of the European defense industry. Let me give you some examples. The United States has one type of infantry fighting vehicle. In Europe, we have 19. The United States has three types of air-to-air missiles. In Europe, we have 13 different types. The United States uses four different types of naval frigates. In Europe, we have 29. Think what that means for our stability, think what that means for our ability to work together and fight together, and the unnecessary costs involved. So we need to spend more, but we also need to spend better. That leads me to my second point, complementarity, not competition. NATO nations and EU members simply cannot afford two sets of forces and capabilities. We share 22 members, so to duplicate would be like competing with ourselves. I know that when it comes to European defense, a number of proposals have been put on the table, and that the debate continues. I took part in this discussion when I attended the recent EU Defence Ministers meeting in Bratislava and again last week in Brussels. Actually, it was this week, I think. It was clearly stated that there is no intention to create a European army or establish military headquarters similar to that of NATO's shape. And it was also made clear that NATO remains the foundation for collective defense of those countries that are part of the alliance. So, at least some of the ghosts of the past appear to have been laid to rest. To make sure that remains the case, we must have full transparency and the involvement of non-EU NATO allies. That is my third point. Allies such as the United States and Canada to the west, Iceland and Norway to the north, and Turkey and Albania to the southeast are not members of the European Union. But together, they are essential for European security and will continue to be. After Brexit, non-EU allies will account for 80% of NATO's defense spending. Three out of four NATO battlegroups to be deployed in Poland and the Baltic states will be led by non-EU allies. So we cannot afford to decouple European defense from non-EU NATO allies. They all have an important stake in European security, and we must continue to acknowledge that. One way of doing so is by developing stronger NATO-EU cooperation. This will also reinforce the transatlantic bond. The joint declaration that I signed together with Presidents Tusk and Juncker in Warsaw in July raised our cooperation to a new level. Both organizations face security challenges of a new depth and complexity, and neither has the tools to overcome those challenges alone. NATO has a unique set of experience, expertise and capabilities. A tried and tested command structure, key enablers such as AWACS surveillance planes and drones, and high-end fighting capabilities. Our ability to do both collective defense and crisis management complements perfectly the wide range of capabilities the EU has to offer. Together, we can be a formidable force for good. Our combined efforts in the Aegean have been a major step forward, helping to cut the lines of illegal migration. Last week, we launched the maritime security operation Sea Guardian, with ships, submarines and maritime patrol aircraft operating in the central Mediterranean, which will also be used to support the EU's Operation Sophia. NATO and EU cyber defense teams already participate together in exercises and have agreed to exchange information about threats and share best practices. We are working to implement the joint statement we made in Warsaw, and this is one of the most important things when it comes to how to strengthen further the cooperation between NATO and the European Union. And we are doing so with full respect for both organizations' distinct mandates, decision-making autonomy, and institutional integrity. Next month, High Representative Mogherini and I will present concrete proposals to further strengthen NATO-EU cooperation in 7 key areas: countering hybrid threats, operations, cyber defense, defense capabilities, supporting the defense industry on both sides of the Atlantic, exercises, and training and capacity building for our partners. When NATO and the EU work together, we can deliver real security for our nations and beyond. Ladies and gentlemen, exactly 100 years after the final day of the Battle of the Somme, we must remember. Peace and security in Europe cannot be taken for granted. In these uncertain times, we need strong American leadership. And we need Europeans to shoulder their fair share of the burden. But above all, we need to recognize the value of the partnership between Europe and America. A partnership on which we all rely and which we all need to nurture. Because united, we are stronger and we are safer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Secretary General, thank you very, very much for that. You touched on a lot of extraordinarily important things, and I'm sure you've spurred a lot of thought out in our audience. But before we come to all of you, we wanted to have a little bit of a conversation up here and maybe elaborate on some of these things and maybe talk about some of the things that you might not have mentioned but you might like to mention. And maybe I could start this way. I mean, I was very struck by your evocation of the Somme. And it also reminded me in a way of a comment that we had from the famous historian Margaret Macmillan at our Brussels Forum last year, where she talked about the speed with which stability disintegrated in Europe in 1914 in a period of weeks. And at a time when I think most of us would agree things moved more slowly. And I'm wondering whether you would agree that we've been in some sense too complacent about European stability, maybe even about our critical alliance relationships. Is that a danger at a time of great political flux on both sides of the Atlantic?
We always have to be focused on potential dangers, and one of my main messages in the speech today is that actually we are faced with more instability, more unpredictability, and more dangerous world than we have been for some decades, especially after the end of the Cold War. But at the same time, I'm actually impressed by the way NATO has been able to respond and by the way NATO allies have been able to adapt and respond. So that's in a way the big difference if you compare today with the previous century, is that we are responding, we are adapting to a more dangerous world. Therefore, I'm optimistic when it comes to our ability as a transatlantic alliance to continue to keep Europe stable and to respond to all the challenges we see, both to the south and to the east.
The summit of Warsaw was widely hailed as a success, and it accomplished a lot. But clearly it, as you would imagine, left a lot of unfinished business as well. I mean, could you say a few words about that? I mean, looking towards the next summit, looking towards the NATO agenda over the next months and year, what is there at the top of the agenda for you?
So the Warsaw Summit, in a way, had three main topics. One was collective defense in Europe, responding to a more assertive Russia in the east, but also partly in the south. Project stability, to address instability to our south with terrorism, ISIL, Iraq, Syria, and strengthened NATO-EU cooperation. And the good thing is that on all these three different areas, we are able to both identify a lot of progress, which has already been implemented, and to outline the way forward with the United Alliance behind. Just briefly on collective defense in Europe, We have done more of the last couple of years than for many, many years. We have implemented the biggest reinforcement to our collective defense since the end of the Cold War. We will deploy 4 battle groups in the Baltic countries and Poland. We have established small headquarters in 7 countries in the eastern part of the alliance. I think actually it's 8. And we have tripled the size of the NATO response force, so we can reinforce quickly if needed. And we have established this new high readiness joint task force. So we have already done a lot when it comes to collective defense in Europe, and we agreed to do more at the Warsaw Summit. On top of that, I'm also, what should I say, at least encouraged by the fact that we are now seeing the increase, we are seeing the first steps towards increased defense spending in Europe and Canada. And to be honest with you, I was not certain that that was going to happen. Because even if that was decided at the Wales summit, it has happened before that politicians meet, make decisions at international meetings, and then go back home and do not implement. But this time, actually, the politicians met, made decisions, and went home and started to implement. So that is really encouraging. Still a long way to go. But 3% real increase in defense spending in Canada and across Europe in 2016 is a significant step forward. And Estonia is already at 2%. Soon the 2 of the Baltic countries will be there. Poland is at 2%. Romania is close. For instance, Germany has also now started to increase defense spending. So there are, and then you have UK and others, which are already at 2%. So Europe is moving in the right direction. This has been my main topic in all my meetings with heads of state and government, and also some minister of finance in my different meetings in NATO capitals since I took over in October 2014. So collective defense, we are delivering. On projecting stability, well, we decided to continue in Afghanistan. That's part of our efforts to fight terrorism. And we are stepping our efforts to support the international coalition fighting ISIL. And then we have these renewed efforts to strengthen NATO-EU cooperation. Only during this year we have been able to agree have in place a formal arrangement between NATO and the EU regarding cyber defense. That is really an area where we have to, what should I say, share best practices, work together. And we also reached an arrangement, or we were able to implement an arrangement regarding the Aegean Sea, how to exchange information. So the fact is that during this year, we have been able to reach more formal arrangements between NATO and the European Union than in previous decade. So we are moving forward on NATO-EU cooperation, and then we had, of course, the joint declaration between the President Tusks and Juncker, and now we are following up that. So my message, it was a brief question and a long answer, is that Warsaw was a success partly because we were able to take stock of a lot of achievements, implementation, but partly also because we were able to outline the way forward, and NATO stands united in a very, what should I say, uncertain time. It's good to see that NATO is so united as we are.
Mm-hmm. And in balancing the challenges in the East and in the South that you've spoken about, there are, of course, a very, very different kind. And I was wondering if you could say a word about how the alliance balances that in terms of its own strategy. Do you need to think about a new strategic concept, or do you sort of have the conceptual tools already in place to be able to deal with this?
So first of all, there's no way NATO can choose between either addressing the instability, the turmoil to the south, North Africa, Middle East, or collective defense in Europe. We have to do both at the same time. Second, we have to understand that when we address instability to the south or even as far away as Afghanistan, that is about our own security. The reason why we are in Afghanistan is to protect ourselves. Because the reason why we went into Afghanistan was a direct response to an attack on the United States. And the reason why we are so focused on the turmoil and the violence in Syria and Iraq, and why NATO allies support the US-led coalition and why NATO supports the US coalition, is of course that that's something which endangers our own security with terrorist attacks in our own streets. So we have to be focused on both, and that's also one of the reasons why we need more capabilities, more defense spending, to be able to do more responding to uncertainty. Mm-hmm. Last thing is that, for instance, Russia is, of course, now present in the east, as Russia has always been, but Russia is also present in the south, in Syria. So to distinguish between east and west, so east and south, and the different kinds of instabilities and threats is not as easy as it was before.
Let me, maybe if I could just pick up on that point. With Russia, I mean, simply understanding what Moscow wants is not an easy task, and if you have a thought about that, it would be great. But beyond that, the question of risk reduction with Russia, how we avoid accidents, whether it's in the Baltic or it's in the Black Sea or it's in the Eastern Mediterranean, where, as you say, Russia is increasingly present again. Where do we stand on that part of the agenda?
In the Warsaw, or at the Warsaw summit, we also agreed, and we had a united alliance behind, a very clear message about defense and dialogue. And I welcome very much that there is such a strong support for both messages. We need strong defense, we need deterrence, and we are implementing and we are strengthening our defense and deterrence. But at the same time, we are underlining and underscoring the need for political dialogue with Russia. And I believe in political dialogue with Russia because Russia is our biggest neighbor. Russia is there to stay. There is no way we can isolate Russia. We have to manage our relationship with Russia. And especially in times with when tensions run high, it's especially important to keep channels for political dialogue open with Russia to address different issues, but in particular everything related to transparency, risk reduction. Because with more military activity close to our borders, it is even more important that we try to have mechanisms in place to avoid incidents, accidents, and if they happen, make sure that they don't spiral out of control. We saw the downing of the Russian plane over Turkey last year, and we have seen some incidents with very unsafe behavior, and of course we have to try to avoid that. We have a lot of exercises, non-notice exercises, and all of this can create dangerous situations. So we have been able to have two meetings of the NATO-Russia Council, and we sit down there and discuss with Russia transparency, risk reduction, and we continue the dialogue with Russia on these issues because with more military activity close to our borders, it's even more important to avoid any miscalculations, misunderstandings, incidents or accidents.
Do you feel the Russians are open to this conversation?
Yes, I feel they're open to the conversation. They have participated in the two meetings on the NATO-Russia Council where exactly these issues have been addressed. And I have also had meetings with Foreign Minister Lavrov and so they are open. That doesn't mean that we agree and that doesn't mean that we have been able to find solutions to all the problems. Some of them are, for instance, connected to something called the Vienna document, which is a document regulating transparency, international observers to different military exercises. And Russia has used many different kinds of loopholes and avoided international observation and inspection of their exercises. This is something which is undermining the transparency and the predictability which the Vienna document aims to achieve. And that's one of the reasons why we are strongly in favor in NATO of the efforts to try to modernize this document, to also include, for instance, short notice exercises, because the current regulations do not include short notice exercises or non-notice exercises. So therefore, there is no international observation. There are so many of these no-notice exercises that perhaps we should look into whether short-notice exercises should then
trigger short notice international observation or inspection. So these are some technical issues, but they are important because they are addressing how can we have the mechanisms, the tools in place to make sure that we have maximum transparency, predictability related to, for instance, exercises, military activities, to keep tensions low.
Do you think in that context, but also in the broader strategic context, that the alliance needs to have a fresh look again at its nuclear strategy, or as I said, the nuclear component of its strategy as it is?
NATO remains a nuclear alliance, and we deal with every issue related to nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence with a very responsible approach, because we know that this is something we have to deal with in a careful and measured way. Our aim is still a world without nuclear weapons, but we have stated that as long as there are nuclear weapons, NATO will remain a nuclear alliance. And at the Warsaw Summit, we repeated that because our deterrence is based on everything from our conventional weapons, our ability to respond to hybrid threats, to cyber threats, high-end capabilities up to nuclear, and that will continue to be so.
Okay. Secretary General, maybe just finally, I could step out a little bit and ask you to sort of broaden the focus somewhat and say a word about NATO's approach to global partnerships, like-minded countries around the world where NATO can help, where others can help NATO, where there's business to be done. How do you see that evolving?
NATO is a regional alliance. NATO's responsibility is to protect and defend all allies, North America and Europe. But to do so, it is in our interest to have a global partnerships and to build global partnerships. And we have seen that in many different ways. For instance, in Afghanistan, the strength of NATO has been strengthened by global partners from Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, Japan. They have participated either with troops and or with financial support. So for NATO, global partnerships is partly about us helping other countries, working with countries in Central Asia, in Africa, but also about many, as you alluded to, many countries also outside the North Atlantic area, helping us in our missions and our operations. Mm-hmm. So we will continue to be focused on global partnerships.
Maybe you'll allow me a last question, yeah. And I can't help asking you. You've been very, candid about the need for the new American administration to engage on these issues and to recommit, if I can say, to the alliance in traditional ways. We'll have to see. But at some point, I suppose you're going to have a conversation with President-elect Trump, or President Trump if he comes for the NATO summit in May, which I'm sure, or whenever it is in the spring that it happens. What's on your agenda? What are you going to say to him? And what do you expect? What would you expect him to ask of you as well? Because that's an important conversation.
So I will welcome him to the NATO summit in Brussels, and I'm looking forward to welcoming him, because I'm absolutely confident that President Trump will maintain American leadership in the alliance and will maintain a strong U.S. commitment to European security. That's important for Europe, but it's also important for the United States, because strong NATO is also important for the United States, as we have seen for decades. Two world wars and the Cold War taught us that NATO is important for the stability in Europe, but stability in Europe is also important for the United States. And I'm absolutely certain that Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump, will therefore maintain a strong U.S. commitment to the alliance. I look forward to our next summit, which will then take place in Brussels. My staff is in contact with his staff, the transition team, and I expect to talk to him very soon, and then I will welcome him to Brussels, and I will also address the need to continue to adapt NATO to a more challenging security environment, both collective defense and projecting stability, fighting terrorism, stability in our neighborhood. And I'm looking forward to work together with him.
Super, thank you. Well, let me open it up to all of you. And if you would, there are microphones that will circulate around. And if you would just catch my attention, but also please tell us who you are and where you're from. That would be super. And maybe if I could go just on the aisle right here first.
Thank you. Colonel Sablon from the Belgian Armed Forces. Concerning Trump and his declaration, do you think it will give a sort of electroshock to the European member states to not only to talk about to do more for their defense, to spend more for the defense budget, but it's not the first time, as you say, that American leadership say that make that statement, but do you think it will give a better impulse to the member states following this Trump declaration? Thank you.
So during the election campaign, President-elect Trump stated clearly that he is a big fan of NATO and that he is all for it. But he also underscored the importance of increased defense spending among European allies and fair burden sharing. That has been the message from so many American leaders for so many years. It has been a very clear message from President Obama. It has been a message from all the senators and all the congressmen I met in Washington the time I've been Secretary General. And it has been my top priority. So to increase defense spending is the message from President Obama, from President-elect Trump, from me, and actually from all leaders of NATO states and governments, because we decided in Wales that we should stop the cuts and start to increase. And the good thing and the encouraging thing is that we have started to deliver. I'm not underestimating how far we have to move, because there's a very long way to go, but it is encouraging to see that after years of reductions, 2015, just some few months after we made the decision to stop the cuts, we stopped the cuts. And we had a small increase in defense spending in 2015. Then in 2016, we will have, the best estimates tells us that we have 3% real increase in defense spending across Europe and Canada. And as I told you, this is around, also if all NATO allies reach 2%, it will be $100 billion, which is equivalent to the total spending of the two largest European defense spenders, UK and France, every year. And of course, the picture when it comes to defense spending is still very mixed, because some allies have continued to reduce, and some allies have just increased very little. But the picture is at least much better than it was just a couple of years ago. And we will continue to push on that. That has been the main message in my meetings with President Obama, and I expected defense spending to be the main message from President-elect Trump. And I will tell President-elect Trump, as I told President Obama, that my main priority is to make sure that European allies increases defense spending. And the last thing I want to say about that is that, of course, it's important that I tell that to defense ministers. But to be honest, all the defense ministers I meet, they agree. So that's not the problem. Then I tell it to the prime ministers. They also normally agree. The problem is the Minister of Finance. So I have started to meet them too. And I tell them too. And then I tell them that when I was Minister of Finance back in Norway in the 1990s, I was cutting defense spending. I was very good at that. But then when I became Prime Minister, we started to increase defense spending in Norway. Because I actually think it's absolutely understandable that many European allies reduce defense spending during the 1990s, as we did in Norway when I was Minister of Finance, because then tensions went down. But the problem is that now tensions are going up. So if you cut defense spending when tensions are going down, you have to be able to increase defense spending when tensions are going up. So I tell them to listen to Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg, not Finance Minister Stoltenberg. And that works.
If I could go just in the front here, please, if we could have a microphone. Mark, please. If you have a microphone just up here. Thanks. No, yeah, just... Well...
Mark Ott, I'm Director General of the Egmont Institute in Brussels. Thank you, Secretary General, for an optimistic message, after all, because we need that. I want to come back on your insistence on EU-NATO cooperation and on complementarity and not competition. I think it's very important. I think it was the spirit since the beginning. It has not always been implemented. There was one partner that has always been a bit difficult in that respect, and it's Turkey, whether it's the Berlin Plus agreements or other attempts at cooperation. Now that this cooperation is all the more important, and as you underlined, the non-EU NATO countries' contribution is essential. The problem seems to be a bit on the EU side now. The relations with Turkey are deteriorating seemingly by the day, and it's also about values. But the alliance is also an alliance of values, not only a military alliance. So how do you see the way out of this now that sometimes politically the president of Turkey seems to cozy up to President Putin, and where sometimes in Syria and Turkey there seems to be a difference in the war aims between Turkey and other NATO allies?
Turkey is a key ally for NATO for many reasons. One reason is just the location of Turkey. The strategic geographical location of Turkey, bordering Russia in the north in the Black Sea, Georgia, and then bordering Iraq, Syria to the south, with all the turmoil, violence, ISIL. So just the strategical geographical location of Turkey makes Turkey a key ally. And not least with all the instability in the Middle East, with the refugee and migrant crisis, I think it's important to remember that Turkey hosts around 3 million refugees. And this is, of course, of great importance for Europe, that we work with them, also addressing the migrant and the refugee crisis. NATO is part of that with our presence in the Aegean Sea. That has been a successful presence, also because partly because NATO has delivered some practical help to Frontex and the local coast guards, but also because NATO has been a platform for cooperation between Turkey, a non-EU NATO ally, with the European Union Frontex. Turkey is also important because they contribute to our missions and operations in Afghanistan, in Kosovo and other places, and therefore, especially when we see challenges both to the east and to the south, we have to remember that Turkey is of great importance for the alliance. I actually think that it is good that leaders in NATO speak to Russian leaders or to President Putin. Many leaders in NATO have done that, and that's a normal thing. It doesn't mean that we agree, but it means that we have dialogue. And after the downing of the Russian plane last year, I actually called for direct contact Ankara-Moscow, because I think it's better to talk than to not talk. And I think also it's important to understand that of course, there is a big difference between, for instance, the threats posed by ISIL. ISIL is an organization we try to eradicate, not talk to, but eradicate. Russia is a challenge. It's a neighbor, but it's going to be there. So we had to talk to them. So therefore, I welcome that there are direct contacts between Putin and President Putin and President Erdogan. The last thing I will say about this is that I visited Turkey in September, and it made a big impression on me to see the parliament being destroyed by artillery and by bombs from F-16s. So during the failed coup attempt, they actually bombed the parliament with the parliamentarians inside. And that was it was an attack on the democratic institutions in Turkey. And I met with many parties, several parties in the parliament, and they all told me how strongly they condemned the failed coup attempt. Turkey has the right to prosecute those behind the failed coup. But of course it is important that this is done in accordance with the rule of law. And I also welcome that there is contacts between the European Council the Council of Europe and Turkey. Because I was told so when I visited Ankara that's the way also they are working on the issues of making sure that this is done in a way which is in accordance with the rule of law. I will go back to Istanbul, Turkey, on Sunday, and I'm looking forward to continue to discuss the wide range of challenges we face in that region and how we can work closely with Turkey addressing all those challenges.
Thank you. If I might just go right on the aisle, actually, the two of you can have a word. Maybe Terry first, if you don't mind.
And after?
Yes. You'll both have a chance, so please, go ahead.
Okay, I go.
Excuse me.
excuse me, I am member of the European Parliament. I am near Marine Le Pen. And I make this dialogue. What you say about ISIS?
And do tell us who you are.
We have to eradicate ISIS, but Hussein is a state, and we have to discuss with a state. I do this. It was not so easy in Donbass and also in Russia. And it changed. I hope that this will a new reality, a new partnership, a new dialogue. And this is very important. But now we have new reality in U.S., new politics. It's also a challenge for NATO, for a new deal, for a new reset. And what will be this reset? Will be the truth about failure in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, in Ukraine, is not more democracy. In Turkey also, I think you have speak. I approve what we have said. And also, and reset, we have to pay more. But also NATO has to understand that we are an alliance of independent states. So what is with the reset, with the new reality, with the new politics, with the new partnership? Thank you.
The NATO is an alliance of 28 democracies, and in democracies, people elect different governments. And for almost seven decades, we have lived with the fact that in NATO allied countries, we have governments, political leaders coming from different political parties with different views on many things. But the good thing is that we have always been able to agree on the fundamentals, on the important things, that we stand together and protect each other. So, of course, we come from different political families. We have different views on many things. But as long as we are able, as NATO allies, to stand together and protect each other, then NATO delivers the defense and deterrence, which is NATO's core task. And as I said, I'm absolutely certain that that will be the case also with the new U.S. administration. It will stay committed to the alliance, to the security of Europe. Strong NATO is good for Europe and for the United States. It was about many other issues, but I can't remember, to be honest. I think I mentioned the most important one.
But back to it. Thank you. Terry, please.
Thank you. It's not going to get any easier now. Mr. Secretary General, you mentioned that you're headed to Istanbul on Sunday. Do you plan to bring up human rights with President Erdogan? There are basic fundamental principles that NATO allies are expected to adhere to. I'm wondering, are you comfortable with how things are unfolding in Turkey right now? You have NATO, you have Turks stationed at NATO installations now becoming asylum seekers themselves due to policies in this country, which is an ally. So I'd be interested in are you comfortable with the way this ally is handling human rights? And what about these officers? Thanks.
It is right that some Turkish officers working in NATO command structure, some of them have requested asylum in the countries where they are working. And as always, this is an issue which is going to be assessed and decided by the different NATO allies. It's a national decision and a national issue. We have seen a number of changeovers in the NATO command structure where Turkish personnel has been changed, and I expect Turkey to continue to fill all its posts at the NATO command structure. And again, this is a national decision of Turkey to decide who is filling the different posts of Turkish posts in the NATO command structure. When it comes to the situation in Turkey, more in general. As I stated, Turkey is a key ally because of its strategical location, close to Russia in the north, Black Sea, the turmoil, the violence in the south, with ISIL, Iraq, Syria in the south. Turkey is also important for the migrant and the refugee crisis and a buffer for the rest of Europe. And I think it is very important that the rest of Europe understands the important role Turkey is playing in managing the migrant and refugee crisis. NATO is based on some core values: democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty. And I expect all allies to live up to those values. When I visited Turkey in September, the message from the Turkish leadership was that they would prosecute those responsible, and Turkey has the right to prosecute those responsible, those behind the failed coup attempt. But they also, the message was also that this will be done in accordance with the rule of law. They also told me that they are in contact with the Council of Europe, because the Council of Europe is responsible for the European Convention on Human Rights, and that they are working with the Council of Europe to make sure that the rule of law is implemented in accordance with the Convention. And I'm looking forward to go back to Istanbul on Sunday, also because the reason why I'm going to Istanbul is to attend the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And the NATO Parliamentary Assembly is an open democratic forum with people from, or with parliamentarians from all the NATO allies. And that's an open forum where I expect to have an open debate. Again, different views, different positions, but being exchanged between allies, parliamentarians from NATO allies in Istanbul in the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. And I think that just, in one way, underlines the importance of NATO. That NATO is a platform for also exchange of views, and I expect that to take place in Istanbul when I meet them on Monday.
Can I just go right on this side over here, please? And do please tell us who you are and where you're from, all of you.
Thank you, Ian. Julian Barnes with the Wall Street Journal. Secretary General, as we've seen NATO make decisions over the last couple years, bridging the divide between southern-focused allies and eastern-focused allies, there has been an important role for the United States in building consensus, helping Europe overcome its divisions on security questions. Do you at all worry that a different, more transactional approach by a new administration might mean that there is less of a U.S. role in forging coalitions, and could that mean that NATO moves slower in the future?
So I am confident that the new administration will continue to provide U.S. leadership in NATO, because that is in the interest of the United States. The different coalitions that have been forged and established either as among NATO allies but outside the NATO framework, like, for instance, the coalition fighting ISIL, or the coalition which NATO is leading in Afghanistan, are both examples of coalitions which are absolutely in the interest of the United States. So I'm confident that the United States will continue to see that this kind of coalitions where NATO allies participate is something which is of great advantage for the United States. The biggest coalition ever has been the NATO operation in Afghanistan. Hundreds of thousands of European soldiers, and also from Canada, has been part of a military operation, NATO's biggest military operation ever, as a direct response to an attack on the United States. So it's in a way not possible to understand how the United States should have less interest in having that kind of coalitions where European allies are actually helping the United States, as they often help us. And the same with the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIL. This is not a NATO-led coalition, but NATO plays a key role providing direct support with the AWACS planes, with training Iraqi officers, also with the work we do, for instance, in Jordan and Tunis and in the wider region. But also the fact that the efficiency and the strength of the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIL is very much based on the ability to work together, which has been developed through decades of NATO exercises and decades of working together in military operations, NATO military operations in Afghanistan and elsewhere or in the Balkans. So strong NATO is good for Europe and it's good for the United States. And we have seen that over decades, especially when NATO allies in different ways have contributed, helped, fought along with the U.S. in different coalitions, fighting terrorism instability.
Just in the back, my colleague, please.
Hi, my name is Corinna Hirst. I work for the German Marshall Fund, but I'm also president of Women in International Security. And I would like to ask you a slightly different, but I think very related question. As you're trying to make the business case for NATO again, are you at all considering diversity? And what I mean by that, and if you look at what private sector is doing, really paying attention to diverse teams and diverse companies so they're reflective of the societies that they're serving or the clients that they try to attract. It's about covering each other's blind spots and bringing new perspectives to the way of thinking. And in your case would be sort of policies and sort of directions moving forward. And I also would like to ask you, this is related to this, but, you know, diversity is more for me than just gender. It's about age, it's regional representation, it's political representation. But I also, in light of the new elected president, I would like to know, what does it really mean for you to be a feminist? Thank you.
First of all, NATO is an alliance of 28 nations, soon to be 29. And also all the way, also and NATO, what should I say, organize or is an alliance encompassing countries from also United States, all the way from the Pacific, all the way over the Atlantic, to north with Norway, to the south with Turkey, and then the Baltic countries and many different countries. So there is no lack of diversity. We have a lot of diversity in NATO. So my main challenge is not in a way to create diversity. My main challenge is to create unity out of all this diversity. Having said that, of course, I welcome diversity. I think that's one of the strengths and one of the good things with NATO is that we are a big alliance with 28 members, with people and the cultures representing a wide range of diversity. So that's the reason why I'm all for NATO, because NATO is an alliance of representing different people, different societies, different diversities, all of the North Atlantic area, but where we agree on some core values and we agree on the importance of defending each other. So we are united in defending diversity. And that's the beauty of NATO. I am a feminist because I believe in equal rights between men and women. And for me, to be honest, it's a bit strange for me to have to say that, because for me, that has been obvious since I was born, or at least as long as I can remember. And if you have met my mother, you will understand why. So she taught me in a way the importance of feminism and of equal rights between men and women. And I think perhaps I told some of you before that my first official post or appointment was to chair the Norwegian Royal Commission on the Role of Men in the Norwegian Society. And that was a commission which was established back in 1986. And it published many reports on how Norwegian men could contribute more to equal rights between men and women. And we also put forward a very concrete proposal, many proposals, but one of the most important ones was to have a leave for the fathers, which was exclusively for the fathers when they became fathers, also when the family got the child. And I think now it's 12 weeks in Norway. And actually, it was 14 when I was prime minister, then it was cut to 10, I think. But that doesn't matter. At least it is some weeks which are exclusively reserved for the father. So in Norway, men are staying home alone with the newborn children. And I think that's good for the children, it's good for the mother, and it's good for the father. It's a bit shocking for the father, but it contributes to equal rights between men and women.
Thank you. Just in the front here, please, if I could have a microphone.
Thank you. Yes, Brooke Singer, Jane's Defense. I just have one question to clarify the budget situation. Europe is faced with rapidly growing instability. You've said that yourself, even more so than a year ago. So the Wales summit and the 10-year schedule, do you think that's still appropriate today? Or should the member states, the nations, agree formally to accelerate that schedule? Growing instability, 10 years to get there. Is that good or bad? Thank you.
Yes, I don't see any reason to change that decision. We actually reiterated the decision at our summit in July. Stop the cuts, gradually increase, reach 2%. But, of course, there are many ways to reach 2%. You can go like this, or you can go like that. So, in a way, it's better to... the sooner, the better. But the three main pillars of the decision, stop cuts, gradual increase, and reach 2%, is a very robust message, and it's sufficient, but I will push for as rapid implementation as possible. And as I also said, it is encouraging to see that we have started to move, but it's a very long way to go, at least for some allies, and therefore we should not relax. And I'm expecting this to continue to be, or I'm not only expecting, this will continue to be my main priority, and I'm absolutely certain that President-elect Donald Trump would also make this his top priority in the engagement with European leaders.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Secretary General, I'm also very conscious of your time, and so maybe if I could group, take two, and with apologies to the many hands I see out there, that would be great. Right here, please.
Thank you, Secretary General. Pascal Ngabori from the Global Relations Forum. I have two questions. The first one is, do you think that European countries shouldn't get, apart from the increased capabilities, a stronger leadership, a stronger voice, and more articulated interest in order to make constructive proposals and not to be always in a wait-and-see attitude? And my second question is a bit confronting. Are European countries able to care themselves of their security? I mean, apart from the United States, you mentioned the fight against ISIL and Afghanistan. What would it be without the United States? I mean, so it's not only about increased capabilities, but also about leadership. And finally, are the strategic interests of the U.S. not moving towards the East? Thank you.
Right. Well, let me go right next door here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Uwe Obtenhögel. I'm head of the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung's office here in Brussels. You stressed so much the need of more intense cooperation between NATO and EU. But if you look at the European Global Strategy, the new one, it's talking about strategic autonomy. So my question would be, how do you see the complementarity between the EU and NATO? What can the EU maybe already do better than NATO? Or what would you envision should be the complementarity between the two?
Okay, thank you very much. And I will apologize to all of you. I know there are a lot of hands, but maybe we could turn to you, Secretary General, for those last two on U.S. leadership and the pivot question. And the question of complementarity between EU and NATO.
So first of all, I think it was Ursula von der Leyen, the German defense minister. She has stated several times in the media that stronger European defense is not an alternative to NATO. It is about strengthening the European pillar within NATO. And I welcome that, and I absolutely agree with her. So as long as stronger European defense is not something that is competing with or is presented as an alternative to NATO, but is strengthening NATO, strengthening the transatlantic bond, then it's absolutely fine. And in one way, it would be strange to say that it is a problem that Europeans start to strengthen their defense, because that's actually what NATO has been calling for decades. So if the Europeans now start to deliver on that, why should we regard that as a problem? So stronger European defense, meaning, for instance, by addressing real problems, like, for instance, the lack of capabilities, it's good for Europe, it's good for EU, it's good for NATO, it's good for the transatlantic bond, and it will contribute to fair burden sharing. And therefore, I think also would contribute to even stronger commitment by the United States to the transatlantic alliance. Because one of the challenges for the transatlantic bond is, of course, if the burden sharing remains as unequal as it is today. That can really undermine the transatlantic bond. So the only thing I am worried about is that if the European Union started to develop command structures which are so duplicating the command structures we already have in NATO. We don't need that. We have challenges enough with filling, those command structures are filled with people from the European Union. Also, not all of them, but many of them. And again, as Ursula von der Leyen stated in a meeting I attended, that that would be to compete with ourselves, because 22 European Union members are also members of the NATO, so that would be really to just duplicate ourselves. It's no problem. Also, of course, Europe should have an articulated voice, and Europe has an articulated voice, as the United States has, as Canada has, and as even Norway has. So we are an alliance of 28 independent sovereign nations, and we all have articulated voices. And that's, again, no problem, as long as we're able to meet, sit together, and agree on collective defense, acting together, and defending each other. So that's not, again, a problem. It's something we welcome. We like that. That's the reason why we are in favor of NATO, because there are 28 independent, articulated voices standing together. And that unity is much stronger than a unity which is enforced on us. This is something we do by our own free will, that we are part of this alliance. I'm actually now answering both questions in one.
Perfect.
Complementarity with the EU. So NATO has some unique capabilities, capacities. I mentioned them, for instance, high-end fighting capabilities. We have the command structure. We have some specific enablers like AWACS and soon drones and other enablers. But perhaps the most important thing we have is, in a way, the forces which are owned by the nations, but which have been trained together, which are able to work together, and which we trust can be able to do high-end collective defense if needed. For instance, the NATO Response Force and so on. EU, they have military capabilities, but they also have civilian tools, diplomatic tools, economic tools, so many other tools that NATO does not possess. And sometimes you also have some overlapping tools, like, for instance, on cyber. EU has a lot of competence, EU has a lot of tools, NATO has a lot of tools, and the thing we have to make sure is that we are working together, and if a member state or ally is under cyber attack, we have to be able to assist, help that state together. And that's exactly what we're doing now. Exercising together, sharing best practices, and being prepared to assist together a member state. Infrastructure, the same. So again, as long as we have a pragmatic, relaxed approach, I'm absolutely certain that we will find ways to work together, not duplicate each other, but in a way, be a formidable force for good, because we work together in a good way.
Secretary General, thank you very, very much. I think you'll all agree that we have had a very articulated voice from you, and a very candid one on a lot of different issues. It's exactly the kind of conversation we hope to have, and we thank you very much for that once again.
Thank you
very much. Great pleasure. Before we go, let me also just express my thanks to my GMF colleagues here in Brussels and elsewhere for this, and to all of you who've joined us here in the room, but also via live stream. We look forward to having you with us again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah.